Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mary Davis. I represent the appellant Lisa Locke. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal. There's a single issue on appeal, and that is whether the district court committed procedural error when it failed to consider and rule upon two of the appellant's issues at sentencing, and that is whether, the court failed to consider that Ms. Locke agreed to cooperate but was not allowed to, and also that the actual loss in this case was far exceeded by the intended loss, and it was argued that Ms. Locke was entitled to a lower sentence based on that factor. It's clear that both of these issues were well briefed and certainly argued before the district judge. But at the time of sentencing, and there was a lot of discussion back and forth considering these issues. So it was well understood by the district judge that these were issues that Ms. Locke was raising that she believed should affect her sentence in the end. However, when the court actually imposed the sentence, there was no discussion whether these arguments were accepted or rejected. There's no discussion whatsoever concerning them.
I thought he did expressly note them, though.
Excuse me?
Did he not expressly note them?
He did not. At the time of imposing the sentence, he said, I'm considering, 3553A factors. But he didn't specifically say whether he was accepting or rejecting those two particular issues regarding the cooperation and the loss amounts.
Did he note them, though?
Not when he imposed the sentence, he did not. And I believe that...
Did he note them at any time?
When there was a discussion of them. Right, there was extended discussions.
There's no doubt he was at one point aware of them.
He was aware of them, and certainly they were issues that were raised and put before the judge at the time of sentencing. And it is our position that once the issues are raised, it is incumbent and mandatory upon the district court judge to make a ruling one way or another concerning the issues.
Hasn't the Supreme Court in Rita and other cases, lower courts, said that you don't have to discuss each issue as long as it's clear from the overall record that each issue was considered?
Right. I think, yes, that's true.
Between discussed and considered is, I suppose, interesting to draw. But if the issue's raised and has been part of the preceding discussion, it certainly seems odd to suggest that the district court wasn't considering those issues as part of the overall determination of the factors that went into the sentence.
I don't believe that's necessarily true, because it may well be that the judge just didn't want to have to decide those issues and therefore chose to ignore those issues. I think otherwise, every time an issue is raised, there'd be no requirement that the judge ever rule on the issues. If we're going to say that an issue was raised, then I think we have to have some guidance from this court to the lower courts that once an issue is raised, you got to say either yes or no to the issue. There doesn't have to be prolonged discussion of it, but I think there has to be a ruling about whether the court is accepting the particular position of the defendant. Here, there was nothing. The court basically said okay in response to both of the issues that were raised.
The two issues being again,
that Ms. Locke offered to cooperate but was not allowed to, because they were the government was asking for information concerning family members that Ms. Locke was not prepared to talk about. But she was prepared to talk about the offense and
the discussion. Go ahead.
Well, the judge, in response to that one of the two factors, seemed to have considered it in his colloquy with you, saying, how do you expect me to take account of this? Are you trying to quash the agreement? You said no. He said, what am I supposed to do? And he's pretty clearly indicated there was no way, without a 5K letter, there was no way he could take this into account in the sentencing feature.
I believe when defense counsel was having this discussion with the judge, the judge asked whether it was the intention of the defendant to say it somehow impacted the plea and And the answer was no, that she's not, was not attempting to withdraw the plea, but rather it affected the sentence. And I don't believe the judge ever went into a discussion of saying, I need a 5K one motion.
No, he didn't. He just said, I don't see how, or how am I supposed to take account of that?
And, but he can. I think there is case law, or if the judge thought that he couldn't, but he never ruled. He just, I mean, there's discussion back.
Well, that suggested that he had pretty much come to closure on that issue, but there was no way in his view that he could take account of it. What was the other matter you raised?
The other issue was, and I think this may have also been raised by the district court judge, was that the the intended loss was, I think, close to three times the actual
loss.
Yes,
he did make reference to that.
And there was discussion
saying in spite of the ratio of almost 3-to-1 or something.
And, right.
So, again, he seemed to, that was in the sentencing itself that he said that, wasn't it?
That
he is aware of the disparity, but because one of the reasons that the actual loss was so much less than the intended loss was only that the defendant was unable to negotiate the checks.
Exactly, right, yes.
So he took account of that as well.
Right, but he
kind of blew it off and said that doesn't count for much. It doesn't reflect on a lack of intent to deal with, to create a larger loss.
Right, but I think, but the judge never actually, at the time of sentencing, said, no, I don't think that you're entitled to a lower sentence because you offered to cooperate. He never said that. He never said that any time during the sentencing. He never said...
No, he just, on that one, he just said, I don't, how am I supposed to take account of that?
And then defense counsel responded that you could take account of that by giving a lower sentence. I believe that was the discussion. And then the judge said, okay, and then asked government counsel a couple of questions concerning the cooperation issue. But there was never an actual ruling by the judge on that issue.
Well, on the second issue, which is more empirical, is it your position he has to say, I'm finding the loss at 500 million, that he has to say, and I am rejecting the loss of 20,000?
I think the judge, if this is what he intended, which I he probably did, but I think the judge was required to say, I'm denying the request for a lower sentence based on the actual loss because I believe that Ms. Locke, whatever reason, I think the bottom line is that, you know, judges don't have to do a whole lot, but they have to do something, and making a ruling so that this court knows what the reasoning of the court was that when the sentence was imposed.
Now, what about the fact that defense counsel didn't say anything at the end of the sentencing hearing when the judge said, is there anything else we need to address? Wouldn't that have been the time to, this goes to the plain error standard of review issue.
Well, the judge didn't say, is there anything else we need to address? Is there anything we need to address that we haven't already addressed or already argued?
Is there anything else we need to address?
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think there's more that follows.
No, that was the answer. I'm on
122.
I'm on 122. Ask both counsel, is there anything else we need to address? No.
All right, but on page 120, the court said, are there other reasons? Let me ask counsel if they know of any reason other than the reasons already stated and argued why the sentence should not be imposed, as I already indicated. And I think from what it sounds like what the judge is asking, is there anything more about the sentence that hasn't already been addressed?
And well, you could say there, as some courts have required in order to preserve the objection, you haven't adequately addressed, you could say what you just said to us. Judge, you haven't adequately addressed these two issues.
Right, and I think there's a fine line. I don't do a lot of district court work, but I think there's a fine line in telling a judge, look, you've made mistakes. And after something has been gone over and gone over and over for hours on end, and
the problem that I see is there's just such a waste of resources in these cases where it could be so easily resolved, this entire appeal, if there were a requirement that to preserve an objection like this, or at least to preserve it subject to something other than plain error review, you have to actually say something at the conclusion of the statement of reasons. And some courts have required that, right?
Some courts do.
Are you aware of any problems that have, this would be hard to do, but are you aware of any problems in those circuits where that requirement is in place?
I'm not aware of any problems, but I would guess that perhaps there's issues then of raising ineffective assistance of counsel claims where you're expending resources yet again
right.
on those claims.
That's true.
So I think it's best to not impose a plain error standard in situations where it's very clear that the issues were raised.
Why not, though? What's the practical problem?
The ineffective assistance of counsel, 2255s being filed in the district court. The district court has, it's probably easier to deal with a remand.
That's an unusual, it's a somewhat unusual argument to say defense counsel with such a requirement are going to miss it a lot of times.
Excuse, what?
I think your argument is that defense counsel, if there is such a requirement, defense counsel oftentimes will forget or mistakenly not comply with the requirement, and therefore we shouldn't impose the requirement in the first place.
Well, I think, you know, defense counsel forgets things, yeah.
But if there were a clear requirement, presumably, and district judges were aware of it too, presumably there would be more colloquy and just avoid all these appeals. We're getting, although fewer now, but a fair number of appeals on failure to sufficiently explain that just seem could have been so easily resolved.
Right, and I guess my response is it could have been easily resolved if the judge had explained the reasons, okay. And that would have taken care of all the problems, and we probably wouldn't be here today. Any other questions?
Okay, thank you. No, thank you, Ms. Davis.
May it please the court, Leslie Ann Girardo on behalf of the United States. The district court did not plainly err in sentencing appellant in this case because the court's explanation of its sentence adequately detailed all the factors on which the sentence was based, and context demonstrates that the court actually did consider but rejected appellant's arguments that in the unique circumstances of this case, the agreed upon 60-month cap specified by the plea agreement should be departed from because of her allegedly thwarted desire to cooperate or her alleged disparity between actual and intended loss. I think it's also clear that the court did not abuse its discretion in rejecting those mitigation arguments because neither had any merit.
If a district court does not discuss an issue that's been raised by the defense counsel, when could we conclude that the district court failed to consider it?
I think if there was no indication, and the example I would give is in the Ayers case, there the defendant had mitigation arguments and that it wanted, the appellant wanted to present, and the court said, well, I'm not going to hear any evidence as to that. I'm not going to address those.
So there has to be a statement by the district judge, essentially, I'm not going to consider that.
Or a complete absence of any indication that the court has considered it, which is
That latter, that's empty in my view, because if the judge doesn't discuss it, how are we going to know one way or another on that?
I think if the judge doesn't discuss it, it's a much harder question. But here we have the court did discuss it. The court did actually have a colloquy as to both of these issues with appellant's counsel.
Okay, so I see what you're saying.
Right. So here we know for a fact that the court did address these issues.
Well,
it was
a colloquy and then didn't address it, though, in the statement of reasons.
Well, as to the, I would say that as to the question about the cooperation, the court didn't specifically mention it in the statement of reasons. I think that's actually not quite true with regard to the alleged disparity between loss, actual intended loss. During the colloquy on that issue, the court said to appellant's counsel, well, you know, you're pointing to this difference between actual and intended loss, but some of that intended loss was attempted loss. The court then referred to that again during its pronouncement of sentence, saying, you know, there was an actual loss of $120,000, an intended loss of $345,000, part of which was attempted loss. But this was a long-term scheme. It involved a lot of planning. So clearly the court was looking at that and lumping it with all the other particulars of the nature of the offense. And so the court was well aware that that was an issue and clearly rejected it. As to the mitigation point, you know, the court was aware that appellant was asking for a reduction because of her alleged desire to cooperate. So the court knew what appellant wanted. The court didn't specifically mention that in its statement of reasons, but again, given the fulsomeness of the court's explanation, this is kind of a unique case because it had, the plea agreement came with a 60-month cap, which was already below the guidelines for the, she was looking at 24-month mandatory on the identity theft.
Right.
And then the guidelines called for 57 to 71 months right. on the, I guess it's theft of mail. So the 60-month cap meant that the court could only impose up to 36 months on the theft of mail, which was below the guideline on that particular count. So, you know, the court was already below that point. And I think given that the court explained everything about its opinion about the case, that her prior criminal history, the fact that she was a leader and organizer of this activity, the fact that it was an offense that touched on personal privacy issues of the people whose mail was stolen and their identity stolen. The fact that the offense required planning and took place over a long period of time. I mean, it's clear from context that implicit in that is the rejection of the notion that any further mitigation of sentence was warranted here.
And your argument that there should be a contemporaneous objection requirement, what about the idea that it's hard on the fly for a defense counsel to do that because lots of times, although not in this case, lots of times the judges just leave the bench. So I've heard arguments in prior cases where you'd have to essentially yell at the judge to come back and say you haven't sufficiently explained that kind of thing as being a reason not to require contemporaneous objection for a reasoned explanation.
I mean, there certainly is a line of cases that says when you don't have an opportunity to object, it's a little hard to impose plain error, but that's not the case here. And I think in most cases, the judge does conclude sentencing, as the court did here, saying, is there anything else? You know, the idea that there's some latent ineffective assistance of counsel there, I think is a bit...
Do you think if the judge does not say that we should still have a plain error standard?
No, I don't, but I think it's certainly clear.
That would put the district judges on notice that if they ask that question at the end, which they usually do, but not always, if they ask that question at the end of sentencing and nothing is stated about an insufficient statement of reasons, then plain error will be the standard of review on that type
on that
of claim
right.
on appeal, I mean, which would be systemically probably a good rule.
I think that's right. And particularly here, I mean, you have to note that when appellant's counsel was discussing the mitigation argument, she specifically said to the court, this is not my strongest argument. I'm throwing it in there. So the fact that she later doesn't say anything about it or ask for a more specific ruling from the court at the time that sentence is pronounced suggests that she was satisfied with the court's ruling and understood the sentence. And really, that's what the whole point of the explanation of sentence is for. It's to permit this court to be able to review the sentence, which I think the court can, given the detailed statement of reasons that was given, and also that the defendant understands the sentence, which I think was clear here. So there's really no reason to look behind the sentencing decision here and say, well, we need to remand for clarification. There's really nothing to clarify. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold.
Thank you. We ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Give you a minute, Ms. Davis.
Unless the court has any additional questions.
I think so. Thank you, Ms. Davis.
Okay. All right.
Thank you both. The case is submitted.